I'd like to acknowledge our partners today, Shaw TV films these sessions and shows them during the week. The University of Lethbridge distributes our flyers and our email messages. And the Lethbridge Herald advertises our sessions and covers many of them. And we also appreciate Erickson's Restaurant, who provides us sandwiches and a good lunch every Thursday. The format of the meeting is 25 to 30 minutes presentation. Then we have 30 minutes for lunch and discussion over lunch. And then a 30-minute question period. I'd like to introduce our speaker for today. He's going to talk about the North American Competitiveness Council. Question, is it misplaced power rising? James Moore moved to Lethbridge 3 years ago with his wife, Lorraine, and he has two children. James has an undergraduate degree in philosophy and psychology from the University of Winnipeg and a master's of distance education. He works in instructional design, online learning, and tutoring through his business, Distance Edge Communications. James has always promoted social and economic justice in his work and his travels in North America, Europe, and Central Asia. I'd like you to join me in welcoming James.
Thanks, Cheryl. Everyone hear me all right? The North American Competitiveness Council, NACC acronym, I think that some of us heard about this meeting in Banff last September, and some questions about what was going on there, why it was going on there. I've dug a bit into the the background of this organization. It's a bit peculiar to my mind, but I'm going to speak to the genesis of the organization. I want to describe, some of the background and some of the differences between how the organization perceives itself and describes itself and how I think the people outside the organization might perceive it, especially citizens of Canada. In March of 2005, there was a meeting of the three leaders of Canada, Mexico, and United States. And at that meeting, they decided to form the Security and Prosperity Partnership. This continued on to the following year, March of 2006, where Mr. Martin was replaced by Mr. Harper on the Canadian side. And they decided to follow through with this SPP, Security and Prosperity Partnership, further by creating the North American Competitiveness Council, which follows through on the point that it's an advisory body, so-called, and it consists of 10 of the CEOs of the biggest corporations of the respective three countries. And it looks to maximize the potential for profit. I would say that. That's my interpretation of the council and the purpose of its existence. When it describes itself in terms of security and prosperity, I mean, these are really nice words. They sound good. I mean, everybody wants to be secure and prosperous. So those are the words that are used. But I think if we look at, closer, we start to see that, we start to question, for whom? For whom is the security and for whom is the prosperity? And I think it's very clear to see that, the prosperity is for the corporations. So sort of as an introduction. I'm going to make some quotations here from documents, which I have. I think it's really important to hear the words themselves. The first one, the acceleration from NAFTA is very interesting because the North American Free Trade Agreement itself is being advanced. Sometimes it's called NAFTA Plus, but I'm going to quote from a very pacifist left-wing guy. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. That's Dwight D. Eisenhower, Commander-in-Chief of all Allied forces in World War II on the Western Front and President of the United States. He said that 3 days before he left office. And I think that the North American Competitiveness Council qualifies as what he was describing. It's certainly military-industrial complex. At the meeting in Banff, we had Admiral Keating from Northern Command of the United States. We had Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. We had Gordon O'Connor, the Canadian Minister of Defense. We had General Hillier, Canadian Armed Forces Chief. We had Ron Covey from Lockheed Martin Corporation. I mean, they were all there. They were sitting there with Stockwell Day as well, another Canadian cabinet minister. And the only journalist who was invited was from the Wall Street Journal, who you might say was on side. This council describes itself here. This is written by the executive vice president of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, who act as a secretariat for the Canadian side. And similarly, the Council of the Americas and the Chamber of Commerce acts as a secretariat for the United States side. And he says, this is the executive director, he's talking about the private sector is the driving force behind innovation and growth, and the private sector's involvement in the SPP is key to enhancing North America's competitive position in global markets. He says, and this is quite interesting, the exchange of issues papers launched an intensive period of discussion among NACC members and consultation with governments and business organizations in all three countries. While the latest election results in the United States led to a shift in control of the Congress, there is expected to be little impact on the NACC process. This is because the Security and Prosperity Partnership agenda was designed from the outset to focus on issues that lie within the authority of the executive branch of government in all three countries. So you could say that, in a way, it's short-circuiting democracy. If you have the chief executives and the military, and they have a secretariat, and they're advising and working with executives of the three countries, there's been no, treaty involved in the creation of this council. There's no debate going on anywhere in Parliament. There's no debate going on about what it is, how it is, why it should exist, what it's up to. But what it's up to is one thing is from a corporate point of view, the regulations can be an impediment. And they talk about harmonizing regulation. The American section is working on this, wants to present papers, which will be coming up in June of this year when the summit will be held, probably in Kananaskis. All of the recommendations will be going forward, but one of the chief regulations, one of the chief interests, and this is driven from the American side, is that they want to talk about, and they continue to talk about, a continental energy policy. Now, a continental energy policy makes an assumption. I mean, we are three separate nations. We know that the United States has a national security agenda, which has been promulgated by Mr. Bush. It includes preemptive war, preventative war, which are violations of the United States Charter, or sorry, the United Nations Charter. They're very, very busy to make sure of their energy supplies, and they consume much more than they produce. So when they look at Canada, I mean, it's really nice to talk about a continental energy policy. Well, Canada, on the other hand, you know, we have at present a supply production of just over 3 million barrels a day. Strangely enough, we import 60% of our oil, and 70% of our supply, roughly now, is going to the United States. Within the NAFTA agreement, there's a very amazing article, Article 605. Which I want to read to you. I think that this Article 605 of the NAFTA agreement should actually be printed on all of the breakfast cereal boxes in Canada in both languages, because it's so wonderful. And I don't know, is everyone in the room familiar with this article? This is what it says, Article 605, NAFTA, other export measures. A party may adopt or maintain a restriction otherwise justified, et cetera, under GATT, with respect to the export of an energy or basic petrochemical good to the territory of another party, only if, okay, so Canada, which is a party, can restrict export to the United States, only if, that's the big words, only if, A, the restriction does not reduce the proportion of the total export shipments of the specific energy or basic petrochemical good made available to the other party relative to the total supply of that good, maintaining the restriction as compared to the proportion prevailing in the most recent 36-month period or another such representative period in which the parties may agree. What that means is that when we're presently exporting 70% of our oil to the United States, that we can no longer, under the NAFTA agreement, export less than 70%. So we're importing 60, we're exporting 70, and we don't have the option of exporting less than 70. If there were a problem in the Canadian supply, for example, we can cut back, but only proportionally. We can never export less than that. And in the same article, B, the party does not, only if the party does not impose a higher price for exports to the other party than the price charged domestically. So we can't charge a higher price, we can't export less. And restriction C, the restriction does not require the disruption of normal channels of supply to that other party or normal proportions, such as, for example, between crude oil and refined products and among different categories. Okay, I'm going to put that together a little bit for us now in terms of the Security and Prosperity Partnership. In January of 2024-25, Oil Sands Experts Group Workshop in Houston, Texas, the SPP report, which I have, recommended through the exploitation of the oil sands, which presently are producing about 1 million barrels a day, that it be upped to 5 million barrels a day. Now, if you work that into the percentages, 1 million barrels a day presently being produced out of 3 million, 2 million being exported to the United States, The direction of the production, increase in production from the oil sands is all going to the United States. We have TransCanada building pipelines to Chicago. We have another private firm building pipelines. Those pipelines are going into the United States and they're not coming back out. As the proportion increases of that oil going south, it must remain at the higher proportion. For example, if you get up to 90% of Canadian production going there, that's where it'll stay under NAFTA. What country would do such a thing to itself? I mean, this is amazing, but it's not enough because now we're talking NAFTA plus. We're talking NAFTA plus. Now, speaking in these terms of NAFTA plus, we have, very interestingly, at the Banff summit, the Alberta Energy Department giving a keynote address, and in that address, the number 10 million is used, actually. It's the first time I ever saw it, but in brackets it says equivalent to Saudi Arabia, which is Saudi Arabia approximately is producing about 10 million barrels a day. And what they're saying, you know, I mean, this isn't anything more than a minister saying the number, but it's significant in light of the progression towards continental energy, in light of the Oil Sands Working Group, SPP report, which I've referred to, and then up to 10 million. So what are the consequences? What are the implications for Canada? Well, we have, heard lots of examples of the kind of ecological devastation, the kind of impact that the oil sands development is having on the boreal forest, on the Mackenzie River. For example, the Grand Chief of the Dayto people, who has an interest, a real, very abiding interest in this project, because in order to fuel the oil sands, there's a project called the Mackenzie Gas Pipeline, which intends to bring the gas discoveries in the Beaufort Sea south along the Mackenzie River to the oil sands to help get the gas, the tar, the oil out of the tar into a form that can be exported south. This is part of the process. Well, he talked about his elders and their the things that they'd been telling him about the effects on the Mackenzie River. The Mackenzie River has a watershed of almost 2 million square kilometers. It's just under. And his people's traditional territory is about one-ninth of that. And they're talking about the water levels dropping by as much as 10 feet. They're talking about the effects on the plants and animals. And this is quite far removed from the actual site of activity. But when he talks about that, about the implications for the future, the interesting thing is that, to my understanding, is that he called for a moratorium. He asked for a moratorium when he went to visit the oil sands. He said, this is too much. This is too fast. We already don't know what we're doing. There's been many calls for a moratorium on the oil sands to try and understand what the effects are going on. What is going on? What is the ecological outcome? Well, that's more of a point of view that I think most Canadians realistically would choose to take. Not only most Canadians, but if you think a little bit further in terms of the effects on the plants and the animals, the subsequent viability of the ecosystems, the future of the children and grandchildren that are going to come after us, then you have to think about, you know, what's the matter with the moratorium? I mean, we don't seem to know what we're doing. Let's stop and have a look at things and you know, get some kind of a perspective before we go forward. However, the Competitiveness Council has no interest in a moratorium. It's interested in pushing quintupling production to 5 million, and I give you the reference again to 10 million. So you're going to look at a multiplication of ecological terrorism, I think that's a fair word to use, on the boreal forest, on the Mackenzie River, going forward. Well, why is this happening? Why is this going on? What is the, you know, the huge rush for production? And then when you talk that way, I think you have to look at what is a corporation? You know, they're the ones sitting in the Competitiveness Council giving the advice. Canadian Council of Chief Executives is a driver. They are the secretariat. They have 10 members sitting there. Same in the United States, same in Mexico. The corporation is a really interesting entity. I think, you know, we know that it was given the status of personhood long before women were given that status. And it operates as a very strange kind of person, a person who can actually disappear. Because the point of corporation is that liability is limited. Corporation is not, the shareholders of the corporation are not liable for what the corporation does. And there's a long history of how this happened, why it happened, and ongoing. And it seems to have taken on a form, something like the legend of the Sorcerer's Apprentice, who some of you may remember. The Sorcerer's Apprentice only learned how to start something and get it going, and he was very pleased with it because his job was to pack water up from the river. And so he was able to get it going, but he was never able to stop it. He had no clue how to stop what he got going. And I think, you know, that in their addiction, rush, need for this energy production, for the development of the oil sands, these corporations are looking directly, and as they should, as corporations, as they're legally obligated to their own bottom line and their own profit. The guru of neoconservative economics, Milton Friedman, said, and I think he sums it up very, very well, he said, the only social obligation of a corporation is to make a profit. That's that. And in the making of that profit, what you do is you externalize costs. To maximize profit, you want to socialize your costs, and you want to privatize your profit. And so this is what's driving it. But it's fascinating that, you know, this is all going on without much discussion at all, if any. So now I'm going to come directly to the Alberta point. Ralph Klein, who I would say is a ideological kindred of Milton Friedman, he said, we had no plan. So no plan, Ralph. Well, why should they have a plan? They don't need a plan. The invisible hand will solve all. The invisible hand of the market will solve everything. You don't need a plan. In fact, if you have a plan, like Ralph was being very ideologically correct there, you don't need a plan because you're interfering with the market if you have a plan. So let it go. That's one thing that happened. Second thing that happened after Ralph retired was now we have Mr. Stalmach, and he says, there's be no breaks. So we had no plan, and now we have no breaks. Those are the statements from the leaders of Alberta on this issue. On the other hand, you know, we have a report from Council on Boreal Development or some group which actually tried to value the Mackenzie River. And this is an awkward thing to do ecologically, but they did it. They made their efforts. They talked about ecological services, what it means to have a healthy ecosystem of that size, what it means in terms of reclamation, what it means in terms of healthy water, et cetera, et cetera. And the number they came up with is $450 billion a year. That's the value of that system. Well, the value of a system like that is imperiled, you know, already, and looking at 5 and 10 times production, there's even greater peril coming. But my question that I want to give you at the end really bothers me is why? Why exactly would our elected leaders or ourselves, for whom they represent, only have sitting on this council corporate chief executives who, by law, even if, you know, they're nice neighbors and mean well and, you know, whatever they mean in their own private lives, in their role as chief executives, they have no obligation but profit. That's the way it works. So that's what's advising, that's what's driving, that's what the Security and Prosperity Partnership, and that's what the North American Competitive Council really is. And it should probably be called the North American Profit Maximization Council, because that's the motive that's pushing it forward. Very interestingly, I would expect that, you know, if you see what's happening to the world, and all of us are starting to become concerned, we have the latest climate change report out. We know that we're responsible for the effects. I mean, probably we thought we were before, but it's beyond question now. And you have a North American Council that is locked in the old mentality, only pushing for profit. And as they have to, as they must do, why would the government only choose them for advisors? You know, there's people here who lived here for thousands of years in a balanced way and lived in harmony with the land. Why don't we bring some of the elders? There's some of them still around who remember the ways of before. Why aren't they on the advisory board to the leadership? Or the children in the future, who can see very, very clearly and are concerned about their future. Why aren't they on the advisory board? I have a very, very beautiful quote from an 8-year-old boy who analyzed this whole situation and was talking with Rick Salutin, who's a columnist some of you may know. He was a friend or a relative or, you know, somebody going for a walk with an 8-year-old, discussing this issue, discussing climate change and what's going on and what can we do. And the 8-year-old said, oh, well, it's sort of like make a lot of money now and die, or make less money and live. That's a tough one. That's the kind of advice that we need to consider. And not just the advice from people who have no other option. So that's the North American Competitiveness Council. Thank you.